This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Today's show is sponsored by Miracle Made. Now, you guys have heard me talk about these sheets before. Guys, they're sheets. They have self-cooling properties for better quality sleep. And they were inspired by NASA. So they have all these like fancy thermoregulating qualities because they're all technology and stuff. And honestly, like, I feel like I spent so much of my life just buying the crappiest sheets. And when you find sheets that feel delightful, that's something you hang on to. You know what I mean? You just hang on to that. I mentioned they're self-cooling. They're also self-cleaning. They prevent up to 99.7% of bacterial growth, leaving them staying cleaner and fresher 3 times longer than the average sheets. I can totally attest to that. Like I said, they're super comfortable. They feel luxurious, like nicer than sheets they use in 5-star hotels. For real. They're designed for your skin. And because of the bacteria thing, it doesn't cause breakouts and stuff, which is like actually a big issue for my husband. His face is very sensitive to that. And I'll tell you, these pillowcases have been doing wonders on his face. So go to trymiracle.com/fakethenation. Again, that's trymiracle.com/fakethenation to get Miracle Made sheets today. And whether you're buying them for yourself or as a gift for a loved one, if you order today, you can save over 40%. And if you use the promo code FAKETHENATION at checkout, then you'll receive 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. It's an incredible deal. And Miracle is so confident in their product, it's backed with a 30-day money-back guarantee. And if you aren't 100% satisfied, you'll get a full refund. So upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiracle.com/FAKETHENATION and use the code FAKETHENATION to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/fakethenation. Treat yourself. And thanks so much to Miracle Made for sponsoring this episode.
Fake the Nation, episode 246.
Hello, hello. This is Fake the Nation, where we talk about news, we talk about politics, and where the big ship of Western capitalism gets stuck in the narrow waterway of reason, because let's be honest, there's stuff on there we don't need. We don't need the stuff that's on the big ship of capitalism. I am your host, Nikine Farsad. And in the Suez Canal meme that took over the internet, the huge ship for me was a bag of Cheetos and the tugboat was my willpower. Today, we're going to talk about Biden's first presser and other Biden-y stuff. We'll also talk about the GOP's super weird obsession with trans girls. And we'll riff on this week's unfortunate bevy of really dumb culture controversies. I am so excited by today's panel. So joining me for the very first time, and it turns out me and him have a history, which made it sound like we dated. We never dated, but I was weirdly a judge on some comedy thing that he did with MoveOn.org, and it brought up so many memories. Anyways, but since then, he's now just fully professional stand-up comedian, no longer doing contests that I would judge. He's also the host of the podcast Stradio Lab, which you should immediately be subscribing to. He is the wonderful George Severus. Hi, George.
Hello. How's it going?
And the next panelist on this episode of Fake the Nation, a tremendous episode it already is, where we've exposed my stereotyping skills. We have with us a Fake the Nation alum who we love so much. He's one of the more prolific comedians you'll encounter. He's got 4 albums on the Spotify's and on the iTuneses. You should be listening to all of them. He's just fantastic. I've seen him just obliterate audiences with his wit. Folks, it's Christian Finnegan. Hey, Christian.
Hello, Nagin. Thank you. I obliterate is a very descriptive word for gently amusing drunk people. Having people be like, oh, yeah, that guy. but sure, let's call it obliteration. Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
All right. Before we get into topic number one, I just want to remind listeners that we are now on Patreon. If you want to support the show, Patreon's a great way to do it. You can go to patreon.com/NagineFarsad. There's many levels of support. You can get bonus episodes of Fake the Nation. I know people like that. And we'll be starting those bonus episodes next week. So it is very exciting. Get in on the action. And now Let's get into topic number one. Let's talk Biden. This week, he unveiled an infrastructure bill, which is hilarious because during the Donnie administration, there was always supposed to be an infrastructure bill, but there never was. And here there is one in the first, I don't know, what are we, 60 days? In it, Biden wants to fix 20,000 miles of roads, 10,000 bridges. He also plans on slyly addressing climate change and racial inequities. And the money to do it, that's coming from raising corporate taxes that got cut by the previous administration. So the cost is $2 trillion, which is following on the heels of a $1.9 trillion package. What do you guys think? Like, where does he get off? Where does he what do you think of this this bill, Christian?
Well, I was walking, I went to the deli this morning and I saw the cover of the New York Post, and it's, you know, classic, very subtle, nuanced New York Post headline where it says something like, hand it over. And it's like some, you know, clip art guy of like, you know, clip art picture of a guy being like, what? With like all his money, like having to hand over like wads of cash. And, you know, Biden proposes raising taxes on millions or whatever. And what I would just want to say to, anyone who was fooled by that is, if you are buying the New York Post, your taxes are not going to get raised. No one whose taxes are getting raised is a New York Post subscriber. Maybe one of the other Murdoch papers, say the Wall Street Journal. But you know, that you already know the game they're going to play, which is that, you know, they're going to raise your taxes. Like, no, they're really not.
No, they're not. Really not. They're really not. Why? Also, they just gave you checks for $1,400. You know what I mean? They're not, they don't want to raise your taxes. George, I mean, just in terms of like ambition and doing these big things, like, what do you think of the administration's efforts so far?
I mean, I have to say, I was a big, you know, Bernie and Warren supporter. Biden was in no way my first choice. I think it's our responsibility, even as people who may have voted for him, to criticize him at every turn. But at the same time, it's like, there's something to be said about how he's kind of like this blank canvas. And if there is enough pressure put on him, he can do anything. I mean, it's important to remember that like someone like FDR was never a bleeding heart leftist when he was elected. It was just like the time was right and the mood was right. And there was enough pressure that he ended up, you know, leaving behind this kind of legacy. And I'm like, what if in a weird way, Biden ends up being an incredibly progressive president?
Yeah, and to be honest, I mean, some of the stuff in this bill, and I'll just tell you guys, you know, there's the spending plan would take place over 8 years. It would be the highest government investment in this part of the economy since the 60s. It would cover a wide range of infrastructure projects, including transportation, broadband, the electric grid, housing, jumpstarting manufacturing, growing economic competition with China. It includes money for to train millions of workers, money for initiatives to support labor unions and providers of in-home care for older and disabled Americans, increasing the pay of workers who do provide that care already. And that's actually one of the more interesting things. Here's a fun one. $45 billion to ensure a child is never forced to drink water from a lead pipe. There's some really kind of amazing specific stuff in here, you know, and I think stuff like, you know, let's make sure children don't drink from lead pipes. To me, it feels so bipartisan. How could you disagree with that? One of the interesting parts of the bill, $400 billion, which is the biggest kind of chunk of the bill, would be spent on this kind of in-home care, increasing pay for those people and increasing like the training and the availability of those workers, because a lot of our people are gonna get old, more and more as boomers get older and older. This is like becomes more and more necessary. So it kind of seems, reasonable that that would happen. It also seems a little bit like this is the building, you know, the WPA kind of plan of our time is to train people to go into that. So this infrastructure bill does nominally, you know, deal with like bridges and roads or whatever, but it's also like, let's look at the economy and what it's turning into and what it needs and where a lot of people could get jobs. So that's fun, I think. If that's what you want to call. This fun. Is my idea of fun, Whee! Guys.
Definitely party with so, Nagin.
Party with Nagin is like, I like to talk about really wonky fucking policy solutions. But I think the one of the extra fun parts of it is really how it's going to be paid, which is, also, like I said, raising the corporate tax rate to 28%. It had been cut during, you know, during the Trump administration, and he's not even taking it back to like what it was. So that, I'll tell you that much. He's also talking about raising the rate of the minimum tax on global profits for multinationals, because right now multinationals can reduce their tax liability on profits they earn abroad, which does not make sense. It incentivizes making profits abroad or whatever. Anyways, so that's a thing. Obviously, you know, Christian, what do Republicans, what do you imagine, like, our really, like, delightful Republican friends in the Senate are going to think about a bill like this?
What first of all, what George was saying about Biden, you know, I've definitely had the same feeling that he is way more nimble than I would have given him credit for politically. Like, he seems way more attuned, you know, and somebody, I've heard pundits say this, that he is... he knows where the center of his party is at any given time and sort of adjusts to that. And so that's why, like, when the crime bill was the thing in the 90s, like, that's where he sort of situated himself. And so he doesn't have these sort of strident personal beliefs as much. I mean, I think he has personal beliefs in terms of how to treat people, and I think he's a very humane dude and all that. But I've been very impressed with I thought that he would just kind of be so incremental. Like, I thought he'd be even more incremental than Obama. And a lot of the stuff that Biden is proposing, only Biden could get away with. It's sort of a only Nixon can go to China thing, whereas, you know, Obama, people would be pulling their hair out if Obama had proposed half of this stuff.
Right, all this stuff. Yeah. The Kenyan socialist.
Yeah, so I've been super impressed by it. You know, I think it's going to be important for people to remember that this is an opening bid, and that there will be concessions or compromises. There will be... you know, stuff picked off the edges of it, I'm sure, because I'm sure the GOP will find some small arcane thing to demonize and pretend that the entire $2 trillion is about some, like when there'd be an environmental bill and they would find, like, oh, you know, for research on waterfowls, what is that? You know, they would find some stupid thing to discount the entire...
the marketing campaign against it.
Exactly. And so I'm sure they'll find something like that. And it'll be interesting to see how much gets nibbled off the edges. I think at the end of the day, I think I was pleasantly surprised with the rescue plan. People, when a couple of changes were made before the bill was passed, people, I know I had a feeling of like, okay, here we go. Here's where Biden caves on everything. And he did cave on the Democrats did negotiate against themselves to a degree, but less so than I've seen them do in the past. And I think the Republicans have really fucked this up, and not just this bill, but this entire next couple of years, because I think they've shown Democrats that, oh, they're not going to work with us on anything, period, no matter what. So why the fuck are we even trying? Why are we trying? And, you know, there will always be sort of nervous Nelly centrist Democrats who want to kind of try to get that, obscure Reagan Democrat that they think they can win back by appearing more conservative and punching the left as much as they can. But much less so than in past administrations. I really think that Republicans have finally convinced even the Joe Bidens, even the institutionalists, that, oh, you're not operating in good faith. We're going to go ahead and pass what we want to pass, as opposed to, sending a limp dick across every That's a weird metaphor.
But, oh my God, the imagery of a limp dick just sitting on the, like a giant limp dick sitting on the side of the floor is what happened.
It's like,
in
this
my
is
head.
Our bipartisan solution, and it is a limp dick.
So George, he did a press conference for the first time. First of all, did it even, like, land on your radar that he did his first ever press conference?
I have to say, because I saw this was of all the things you guys sent.
Because it was last
day,
Thursday.
This one really took me off guard because I was like, I mean, I have to say, I read the news every morning. I'm not, you know, ignorant. But I truly was like, I guess I didn't. I don't know. I've heard him speak before. And, you know, I certainly, it's not like I think he's been hiding or anything. But it hadn't occurred to me that this is his first ever press conference. And it didn't make any waves in a way that you would expect something like that to, but I don't know, maybe it just
What is that expectation, George? Why do you have the expectation that a press conference would make waves?
And it's not, I mean, of course, you know, there's the Trump of it all, but then it's also like, even before Trump, an Obama press conference would make headlines for different reasons. And this is just someone who isn't, I think it's actually refreshing that he is not incredibly charismatic and he is kind of like, just reading off a teleprompter. There's something that it's almost like a built-in way to keep someone more honest, like, because I'm not swayed either way by his tone or his
performance.
I don't know, his messaging. I'm just kind of like, I could actually just interpret what he's saying at face value because I'm not charmed by him.
It just feels like some bullet neutrality. Points.
And also, this was
like,
just
such a...
I'm sorry.
Yeah. How'd it land for you, Christian?
Well, it's just, this was such a ridiculous kind of I hate the term the beltway, but it's such a dumb inside the beltway story. The only reason I knew this was a quote-unquote controversy is because people like Peter Baker at the New York Times and other DC journalists were like, it's been 60 days and Biden still hasn't had a press conference. First of all, the definition of the term press conference is clearly very specific. And like George was saying, it's like, Biden's talking all the time. I've seen him take questions. Like, I guess it's not officially labeled. There's not a giant banner saying welcome to the press conference hanging above that it somehow doesn't count. And I understand that there is an instinct among the press, mainstream, and I would say even some of the left press, is to discount the idea that they're in the bag for Democrats. And so they have to sort of make every molehill into a small mountain on the Democratic side. Because, like, all right, five stories about how the Republicans are burning orphanages to the ground. I better pretend this dumb, ridiculous press conference thing is a huge deal just for balance so that I look like I'm a neutral journalist. And so he did this press conference. And I would say that the press didn't really acquit itself terribly well. There's nothing that was gleaned from that press conference that matches up with any of the issues that voters say they actually care about. I mean, Biden made his announcement.
Yeah, like there was no questions from the journalists about the pandemic specifically. Yeah. Right.
Nobody
and they did ask
about
the 2024 race, which nobody cares. They asked about whether or not he thinks he's going to run against Trump. Oh my God, stop it. You know, like these are questions that don't matter. The only thing, you know, he kind of opened the thing being like, we're going to have 200 million doses delivered in 100 days. You know, we're on track to do that. And for me, I'm just like, that's a drop the mic moment. You don't need to speak for the rest of the hour. Like, that's the thing that matters to everybody, you know? Mm-hmm. And and that was newsworthy, and it's, you know, and it's great. The other thing that sort of happened that was a little bit newsworthy was that he seemed to be open to filibuster reform. And one of the things, you know, and again, this is like one of those like wonky, like Nagin is a nerd, but like filibuster reform can come in many ways. There's just removing the filibuster altogether, which means that instead of getting 60 votes to pass something in the Senate, they could just do it with 51. But the thing that happens with the filibuster now is that Republicans are saying, well, just like send an email and be like, no, we filibuster that. So you can't just pass it with 51. You can't just go forward and vote on it. And And the way that it used to be was that you had to go read from a phone book or whatever for 43 hours. And like, that's how you filibustered, which meant the number of filibusters that actually happened were very low. And now the number of filibusters is doubled or tripled, or I don't know what the specific number is, much higher, because all you have to do is just like send an email or whatever. But like, no, we filibuster. You know what I mean?
And it's baked into the process. Like, yeah, things aren't even brought to the floor if they think they could be filibustered, you know?
Exactly. So making the filibuster difficult, I think, is a great idea. And it seemed like something that Biden, you know, was maybe into. And when we've got such pressing issues, I'm into that. Or like carving out like voting rights as something that can't be filibustered or something like that. There's ideas like that swimming around. So maybe, but all in all, I guess I don't want to say sleepy, but it was just like an unevent. Ellen, how would you give it an overall rating?
I think it kind of speaks to the general, like the changing face of the media landscape in general, or the media ecosystem in general, that something like a presidential press conference simply is not where news is broken anymore. Like, it is just, that's not how it works. It's not like there are, I mean, politicians can speak directly to people through, I'm sorry to sound like a 65-year-old, but like, you know, they can speak directly to people through social media.
Through their cordless phones, you know.
Yeah, like, they have other ways to like put across messaging. Meanwhile, journalists, you know, the good investigative journalists rely on sources and on people that are speaking like way more honestly than Biden would be during a press conference.
Right,
like,
than a televised press conference.
Yeah, like the idea that something groundbreaking can come out of a press conference feels very like 60s to me.
Absolutely.
Like, it simply totally, is just not totally. Like, it's not designed to be that way. And in fact, the only reason it was that way with Trump is because he made them into media events in a self-serving way. Like, they no longer were, they were kind of,
they were,
you know,
already not
editorial.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. They were already not media events before he came on the scene. I mean, there was a couple of things with Obama, but not even really. Yeah. Okay. Well, we are going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll talk about topic number two. And we are back, and we are ready for topic number two. So the new trend in GOP politics, which is a bit of a revival of an old trend in GOP politics, is to fixate on trans girls, especially in sports. For example, South Dakota introduced a bill called the Act to Promote Continued Fairness in Women's Sports. As you can tell, it might be a misleading title. And my question is, like, I guess, why are they so up the ass of this issue? Even in South Dakota, they admitted that, you know, trans girls in sports only affects them in a handful of cases statewide. So what's the deal? What is what's happening here?
For me, what's scary about this is that it is so clearly the beginning of a larger effort to roll back trans rights, and it's like it's kind of a smart way in, I think, if you're trying to appeal to social conservatives. Like, school sports are such an all-American thing, and to be like, school sports are under threat and children are under threat, is a very effective way to get people that maybe don't know a lot about, you know, trans rights kind of like suddenly up in arms and interested. I think at its core, it's really what's upsetting about it is also that it's kind of like targeting little kids that just literally want to have fun. Like, it's not even, I mean, it's just, it's very, it's so cynical in that way. But like I said, first of all, this affects so few people. So like you said, it's kind of, it's the perfect almost non-issue to fixate on. But I'm worried that it will lead to actually like rolling back things like healthcare, which has already started to happen in other places, and honestly lead to a more systemic kind of backlash, if you will, against trans rights, just like we've seen in places like the UK in the past couple of years.
Christian?
Well, you know, I kind of feel like the opposite. I feel like the fact that they're taking it on so seriously is a real marker of weakness on their part. You know, that these are the fights they were having about gay marriage 20 years ago, and mm-hmm. they've had to cede ground culturally on all of that. And they're now down to these handfuls of cases that affect very few people. By the way, I would be very interested to see all these people who claim to be such supporters of women's sports. I'd be curious to go through their social media profiles and see if they've made jokes about the WNBA or women's sports in general. It's like these are not people who support women's sports. They think that anybody who cares about women's sports is not a real sports fan, especially if you're a man and you pretend that like you care. I mean, I'm a big basketball fan, so I'm on Twitter, and a lot of basketball writers or even NBA players will talk about the WNBA, and invariably you'll just get a bunch of just chuds, just, you know, like, you know, just spouting off in their bullshit. And I'm making a blanket statement, but I guarantee you those are probably a lot of the same people who are like, we have to protect, you know, girls against these men playing in their leagues. To me, it's that it's such a absurdly small problem that affects so few people. And mm-hmm. that's my knowledge. I'm sure there's a few out there, but I haven't heard a lot of girls, women, young women on their high school sports teams claiming to have a problem with this. I mean, maybe they exist. I'm sure there's an anecdotal case or two, but it's certainly not. I certainly don't hear as many women talking about this as I do men. And
right.
But to me, it's a sign that they've lost ground and they know it. And it's a very easy thing for people to have a visceral kind of gut revolted reaction to the idea of like a man acting like a woman, like tackling her or like playing volleyball and like spiking the ball in her face. Like, we can't have that. You know, it's a very easy image if you are prone to thinking of women as weak and men as like brutes. It's a very easy thing to latch onto. But to me, it's a sign of that they're flailing. Now, granted, if I was a young trans person, maybe I wouldn't be so blithe about it. I will admit that it's easy for me to have that attitude being a 48-year-old straight white dude.
Yeah, I mean, I think both, you know, it, in some ways, both things can be true. Like, it could be this, like, slippery slope that George is talking about where, like, you know, and also it's like, where you give him an inch. I don't want to give him an inch on this. This is ridiculous. Like you were saying, George, it's not. It's a battleground. It's a really gross battleground because it's a battleground filled with children. You know what I mean? It's mm-hmm. at the end of the day, all we're talking about here is children that want to play sports. And this is a vulnerable population, whether they're trans or not, because they're children, you know? So like, why is this the battleground? It's really, really gross. And also, so I mean, in terms of like school sports, also some sports organizations have already taken into account trans athletes, like the NCAA, you know, requires athletes who are transitioning to female to be on testosterone suppression treatment for a year before they can compete on a women's team. So there's already like some measure of, you know, and I don't know if that's right or wrong or whatever. I can't comment on that, but like, at least there's organizations that are like taking into account what that might mean and what kind of, you know, standards or whatever, or, you know, precautions or whatever you want to call it, they can have in place mm-hmm. to address it in ways that seem more humane than bills like the ones coming out of South Dakota.
Can I just jump in for 1 second? You know, if 10 years down the road, we look and all high school sports are being dominated by young trans athletes.
Yeah.
Like it's a solution in search of a problem, you know,
right.
You know, then maybe we can have this conversation like, hey, you know what? It turns out that these kids in a athletic competition do have an unfair advantage or whatever, but this is all just so fucking theoretical, you know, and it's as if, and it's, you're going to try to stamp out trans rights on the off chance that this some trans kid might want to join the field hockey team? Like, is that is the hill you're going to die on? Like, how about we cross those bridges as we arrive at them instead of...
Yeah, I also think even just that kind of framework even, which I think is what's being pushed, is, you know, you have this group of people that are marginalized and are legally and politically vulnerable, and rather than the goal being to somewhat move towards a path of justice, you are in fact framing them as threats to quote unquote, you know, to cis people, basically. So it's, I think that's what makes me afraid of this, of this becoming something bigger, is like, it is a step towards criminalizing a certain type of person or towards framing a certain type of person as a threat.
Right.
And then once you do that, once someone is marked as a threat, it is so much easier to roll back rights, because it's, you know, the implication is like, oh no, they're too scary, they're too powerful. You know, we can't let them enter these spaces that are sacred in some way.
Yeah, and it's so ridiculous because obviously it's like shifting victimhood from trans people, yes, you know, from trans people to cisgender people is like so ridiculous.
Who didn't even ask,
right?
For it. Like, who haven't even asked for,
right,
the protection, you know?
Exactly. Like, where it's obvious, like, in the, you know, in the people, the cisgender athletes are like, fine. You know what I mean? Yeah. They're fine. And
right.
So, well, they're not,
yeah,
victims.
It's also, we're talking
no one's
about
a victim.
Kids, like, if the issue is, if the issue is like people's size and hormone levels, like, we're talking about teenagers going through puberty. Everyone is all over the place. Like, there,
right,
is,
right,
no, it's a non-issue.
Yeah, one 14-year-old,
yeah,
might
I
be
fucking...
6 feet tall with a beard, and another 14-year-old might be 5'2", you know, like, they're,
exactly,
yeah,
exactly,
development,
yeah,
is so,
yeah,
strange.
Yeah. Well, like, I want to kind of shift the conversation to this, like, idea on the right of owning the libs. And part of this whole thing feels like it's just to make liberals really irritated, you know, because it's like, I mean, you know, the fight for trans rights is real. So I'm not trying to diminish that in any way. But again, like, the number of people that some of these bills address is so extraordinarily limited that it just, mm-hmm, it seems like it's just a plan, a part of a larger plan to own the libs, right? And just, you know, people have heard that expression thrown around, and Politico defined it as such: to own the libs does not require victory so much as a commitment to infuriating, flummoxing, or otherwise distressing liberals with one's awesomely uncompromising conservatism. Where are you guys on this lib ownage? How much of your reactive time do you think is spent on just like this, on reading stuff that they're writing and then feeling flummoxed?
Well, I just want to say one thing in terms of owning the libs with this specific debate, and not to get too dark, but I just think to use a certain community as, what's the name for like a chess piece?
A pawn.
Like a pawn.
Yeah.
To use a community of real human people whose rights are in danger as a pawn for political arguments is actually further dehumanizing. And I think that's, to me, the top line with all of this is like, everything, like, the owning the libs thing is of course true. Of course, all these things are in bad faith. But at the same time, they are, the real harm they're doing, other than the laws themselves, is further dehumanizing people by making their very existence into a topic that's up for essentially like a kind of like debate class, theoretical debate, where people are like, oh, very interesting points on both sides, and like, blah, blah.
But,
you know, there are people's actual rights. So I wanted to mention that without being like overly... I don't know.
No one wants to, like, this isn't just a fucking trolling game on Twitter.
Yes,
this,
yes,
is like, again, I just want to point out, with a lot of this stuff, it is about children, right? They're,
right,
using children,
right,
as pawns, not just any American,
yeah,
children. So,
yeah. But,
so
but you're
continue.
Absolutely right about the owning the libs thing. I mean, it's like, that was the ethos of Trumpism, I think, was, you know, getting a rise out of people. I think there is a very rich history. I mean, a lot of this stuff is bottom up and a lot of it is top down, by which I mean a lot of the language starts on like internet forums and 8chan and 4chan and works its way up. But then a lot of it, and in fact, I think this is like under represented in narratives about this, a lot of it is top down, and that like people with actual interests in these things use cultural debates to further various kind of narratives. So all of these are like theoretical conversations where the last thing anyone actually addresses is how they affect real people.
By the way, did you know that there are people out there who modify pickup trucks that roll coal to spew out like jet black exhaust fumes into the air as a middle finger to environmentalists?
Oh, gosh.
That is owning the libs that requires a trip to Home Depot that I would just be not. I would be like, yeah, this is too much. You know what I mean? I'd rather go to brunch if, like, you know, if owning the conservatives involved me doing some sort of a thing that involved a wrench. No, thank you. You know what I mean? Christian, what were you going to say?
You know, first of all, I feel like as a ostensible comedian, I understand the impulse, because so much of stand-up comedy is about sort of popping balloons and sort of puncturing sanctimony and making fun of people for caring, or making fun of yourself because you got angry about, you know what I mean? Like a sort of undercutting seriousness of things. And a lot of these, a lot of the, you know, online people, they get the whole puncturing sanctimony part, but they don't have any sense of wit or, you know, it's always easy to make fun of people for caring. If you care and the other person doesn't, you are at a rhetorical disadvantage always. You know, if I'm punching you in the arm and you ask me to stop, well, it's a lot easier for me to make fun of you in that scenario than for you to make fun of me.
And unfortunately, there is no shortage of stories where ostensibly liberal people do humiliate themselves
by how much they care.
So it's like when you have story, I mean, not to mention something from years ago that's like a, but it's like, do you remember that story about how like students at Oberlin thought that like the fact that the dining hall served burritos was cultural appropriation or something? Like, you know, stories like that that are so clearly exaggerated then are used as ammunition to be like, well, this is stupid, therefore so are human rights.
Yes. You know, so,
yeah. All right.
I mean, that's why college campuses are such a target all the time anyway.
Exactly.
Because,
right, exactly.
Because it's
right.
Like their kids, like college kids, and this has been true when I was in college, it's true of college, you know, it's where you are at in your developmental life between 18 and 21, is that it's like you found a gun and you've never, like, mm-hmm. the sort of ideas that you've discovered, you don't know how to use them yet. You have no idea how to put them in context, but you're so excited to know all these new words and new phrases and new concepts that you're very strident. And, you know, whether you're on sort of a very liberal, whether you're in a sort of LGBT group or if you're one of those kids who've read the fucking Fountainhead, you have these ideas and you think you're the first person to ever think of them, and you brandish them out there. And now there's social media, so you can broadcast your idiocy to the entire world. And then all of a sudden you have 55-year-old Fox pundits treating you like you're a professional debater. You know, you're a dumb fucking 20-year-old in college.
Right. And so then it becomes, you know, an elephant taking on a mouse of like, you know, where lib ownage is like, okay, I guess you get credit for owning a lib in that situation, but that lib is 19 years old and like typed up a screed, you know, in their, on an old fashioned typewriter because they thought it was cool. And that's the thing you glommed onto, you know, and it does become ridiculous. But I do think, like, in general, I mean, forgetting the 18 to 22 year old, there's also the 22 to 85 year old who also just sometimes are irritatingly, and I know I'm going to use a word that the conservatives love to use, sensitive, right? And that, like, take on some things that you're just like, ah, are we taking that on? You know,
Well, liberals take the bait.
Right. Always. Well, yeah, exactly. Always. And it's weird because what's really weird about that is we have more comedians. So why do we take the bait? The left wing has so many more just general comedians.
And yet the comedy audiences are more conservative. That's something that I've learned over my years of doing comedy, is that comedians skew liberal, but comedy audiences skew conservative, which
is that
frustrating.
True?
Is that absolutely like from
a case study of one Christian Finnegan?
Of people who actually pay money to go out and see comedians live, actually spend dollars and not just sort
spend
of talk about
going
who's
to a club.
Cool, who's uncool, but who actually puts their money where their mouth is. That's why you see all these, you know, like right-wing comedy podcasts that are making $50,000 a month, because hate them though you will, those audiences will pay. Whereas all the liberal comedy audiences, they don't go to a club and pay $20 cover charge. They want to see somebody for free at the underground bar show. You know what I mean? All these comedians they say they love. Have you actually spent any money to support these people? The answer is no. But the conservative audiences, they buy the t-shirts, they buy the fucking mugs, they come out to the show, they get the VIP package,
what?
They do all
I'm
of it.
I'm feeling shocked by this.
Go and play the Dayton Funny Bone sometime.
No. I mean, Nagin, you should just pivot to hardcore reactionary with this podcast, and then
it's a massively lucrative career path.
Oh my God, I've been doing this wrong this entire time.
We have.
Aggressively wrong. Aggressively wrong. No, that said, I've performed in many, many, many red states, and I've had fantastic, jubilant audiences, and maybe they were like, you know, total.
Well, they're probably fans of yours that came out, but I'm saying
right,
the average people who come out because it's Kim's birthday and we're going to go to a comedy club,
those
they're not far
right,
but they're center right. They're like Bush Republicans.
Got you. Which I'm fine with those people.
They're fine. Yeah, I'll tell jokes. Those people
are delightful. Care. Fuck it. All right. Okay, let's move on to the next topic. But before we do, I just want to say to listeners that, as you know, we're at our new home, HeadGum. Things have been going well. Thank you very much. Looking, you know, figuring out where the water cooler is, you know what I mean? How the printer works. It's been very exciting. turns out it's all still in my apartment. Okay. But one thing that has changed is we have a new email. So if you want to email the show, the email is fakethenation@headgum.com. Again, that's fakethenation@headgum.com. We love to hear from you. So we got some emails to the old email address, but this is the new one. So please contact us here with all of your show ideas, topic ideas, guest ideas, all the stuff you like to send us. I'm here for it. And the email is fakethenation@headgum.com. And now we're moving on to topic number three. Let's talk about some really dumb media controversies. Or maybe they're not dumb. I don't know. First, Jimmy Fallon, he had a TikTok star on named Addison Rae, and he had her on for a bit. The bit was basically he held up these flash cards or whatever of a song of dance names, and then Addison would do that dance. She very expertly did it. Apparently, she's like very big on TikTok. I'm also on TikTok. Anyways, I find it embarrassing every time I mention that I'm on TikTok, but I am. Okay. There was a backlash to this because the choreographers of those dances were not credited. For example, Rach0121 on Twitter wrote, all of these dances are made from Black creators, yet they have this, you know, girl in this white girl in the spotlight taking credit. Jimmy Fallon, shameful. Who's TYE wrote, the fact that they have no idea how offensive this is sickening. This is systemic racism at its finest. This white woman is benefiting from a broken system and was highlighted on national TV while the choreographers and actual artists that made the songs weren't even mentioned. Shaking my head. George, what do you think of this controversy?
I mean, I think it's this always happens with new platforms, because what happens is these things, I completely take the points of everyone you just quoted, but even more importantly, not only is it Black creators, but it is a collaborative process among many Black creators. Like, it is
no one person can
take credit for who came up with like a meme or a TikTok. I mean, it's always so funny when people call each other out on Twitter or Instagram for like stealing content. I mean, unless it's like a literal, you know, an actual
right
tweet or something. Like, so much of meme culture is created collaboratively, and right. unfortunately, the way that the super system of, you know, executives that decide who's going to be the next big star works is that they decide who the most palatable person is from each of these new platforms, whether it's Vine or Instagram or whatever else. And they're like, okay, you're now the person we're putting on Fallon. So I think it's like, I mean, I hate to say it, but I don't think it's this girl's fault. I mean, as far as I know, she's like 19 years old.
Yeah, I know.
She was like doing dances for TikTok. And then unfortunately, the way the entertainment industry works is like, people are not knowledgeable or smart enough to be like, okay, there are all these, you know, super cool choreographers and kids doing these dances. What, how do we, I don't know, highlight them
Integrate them,
uplift people that are the most talented and are the most interesting. But, you know, there's this girl that's like very easy to market. She's clearly like fun and you know, good on camera.
I mean, she's a good dancer.
It's
also weird because, I mean, there's a couple of things going on. One, cultural appropriation rate, that was the center point of a lot of these tweets. But also, like black dancers also don't credit black choreographers, right? I mean, it's not like, There's the crediting issue that you talk about, that things are made collaboratively, so sometimes crediting can get murky, but also just choreography generally doesn't get credited. And like, the history of art is rife with people not crediting provenance, right? That's just like the history of art. And so it feels like part of the backlash is just a frustration with just the fact that people never credit anything ever. You know what I mean? It's just and it's just weird to fixate on this one moment as being like, you know, the apotheosis but it's weird to like have this one moment, you know, be the stand-in for like the history
it's interesting
of not crediting
because,
Providence.
You know, what people are reacting against, I think, if I'm doing kind of a generous reading of this, is historically the sidelining of many black artists who are not credited, and it goes back to, you know, Madonna voguing in her videos, and then kind of and people thinking she invented voguing, or featuring the artist Big Frida, but then not putting her name on the song. You know, this is a long history. So I think so often the reason these reactions seem so over the top based on what they're commenting on is because it stems from years of seeing things like this happen over and over again, that then it all comes out with something as seemingly insignificant as Addison Rae doing TikTok dances. Like, yes, I agree with you that like that tweet you read that said it's structural racism at its finest. I mean, not actually structural racism at its finest.
Yeah, it's not.
I can think of finer versions.
Right. Like, but you can still see how it is at least.
Like, Bill Barr was our attorney general, and Addison Rae, you know what I mean, is no Bill Barr, right? Like, Christian, what was your take on this controversy?
A few quick points. One, who really came out of this? Who won? I would say Jimmy Fallon. When's the last time anybody was talking about anything that happened on Jimmy Fallon's show? And I'm not even trying to be snarky about that. I'm saying if you're talking about an attention economy, which we now are, this is the best thing to happen to his show in months. And I would say, two, I would say probably more people, if Addison Rae were to post a new video on TikTok, more people would watch it than watched her on Jimmy Fallon. Even among people who are younger, who probably should know better, there's still this idea that television is this elevated art form, and that it's, I just don't think that many people are watching any of these shows. I mean, I know people work in television. They're all panicked because who the hell is on TikTok who gives a shit what is going on late night television? It's so embarrassing to me to watch Jimmy Fallon, this 50-year-old man, out there trying to appeal to people who are literally 16 years old. None of those people are watching your show. None of them, you know? And so I think it's a little silly. And kind of like what you were saying, is like, yes, it's appropriation, but these things, TikTok, the whole design of TikTok is we all do the same thing. You know, that's what has made TikTok kind of an interesting platform. I understand the idea of, like, you know, Black creators create these dances, but you're participating on a platform that kind of erases ownership intentionally. So it's a little hard then. Now, granted, you could say, well, they're giving this girl ownership of it by having her on Fallon and having her do these dances. But my whole point is, if you hadn't made a big deal about it, no one would have given a shit because nobody watches those shows anymore.
All right. So Jimmy Fallon is the winner. Okay, well, let's move on to the second controversy from this week, or I don't know if it was it wasn't necessarily controversy, but a cultural thing of note was that Jay Leno apologized to the Asian community for his former jokes. He had been, pressured or contacted by the Media Action Network for Asian Americans about jokes he had made in the past. And he said, "I'm issuing an apology. I do not consider this particular case to be another example of cancel culture, but a legitimate wrong that was done on my part." MANNAA, which is the Media Action Network for Asian Americans, has been very gracious in accepting my apology, and I hope that an Asian American community will be able to accept it as well. And I hope I can live up to their expectations in the future. That's just part of his apology. What did you think of this apology, George?
I mean, I would love it if he also apologized for every other joke he has ever said. Because truly,
just not being your cup of tea. Could he just apologize for not being your cup of tea?
Leno was like, growing up, my dad would watch Leno. I think it was also like, you know, being at the time an immigrant, he had never, you know, it was late night. First of all, it was the only one he knew, the only late night host he knew. And he just thought it was so funny. Like, and he would watch the monologues every night. And it was just like, I mean, this was like during like the Lewinsky scandal. It was like not, all I'm saying is that he has many other communities to apologize to if he's starting an apology tour. But I don't know. I mean, I don't think right now, I mean, what do you even say? Obviously, it's good that he apologized. I think, unfortunately, like, you know, Asian Americans have been the punchline of jokes in American media and culture. I mean, you could even argue more so than any other community in an extremely intense way since forever and also up until extremely recently. So I think, I mean, maybe it's good in terms of starting a conversation, but I, you know, it seems like small potatoes.
Well, you know, I don't know, because just like what Christian was saying is like, who's watching Jimmy Fallon, who's listening to Jay Leno? It's actually maybe people who might need to hear Jay Leno apologize about making those kind of jokes. Like, you know, if we're thinking about people like your dad's generation who are like enamored by him, hearing him say, "I should have made those jokes and this has nothing to do with cancel culture and I was just totally wrong," that's powerful. I mean, these people are cultural leaders, you know. So I'm like, let's keep the apologies rolling. Like, let's follow Jay Leno up with, I don't, you know, the next guy. I can't think of like, you know, I'm sure Letterman has some jokes that he could apologize for or whatever. You know, I think these kinds of things matter. I think it's weird that we still. It's like we get an apology. I get that apologies can sound shitty. You know what I mean? That's part of the problem. It's like apologies generally feel like shitty. But also, like, wouldn't it be great to accept apologies? And it's not my job, right? Like, I'm not in the community that was being apologized to, so I don't know, right? Like, this is the Media Action Network for Asian Americans took the lead on this one. He apologized to them specifically. He's hoping that Asian Americans will follow, you know, the community will follow suit. That's all we know. But in general, it's just like, I believe that people can evolve, and an apology is a great start. Christian, where do you stand?
Well, first of all, I think you should apologize for stealing up all the quality denim. I'm joking.
All of the extra inches that were used to go right up to the nips.
Yes, I'm joking because it's not quality denim. Obviously, it's all stonewashed. But
I don't, you know, I understand there's some cynical reasons why this is coming out now. It's because he has a new show that's going to be coming out soon, and he's kind of about to re-enter, in his mind at least,
society.
In terms of his, you know, he's hoping the show will be a hit, and obviously the climate is very different. And Jay isn't one of the, Jay, like I know the guy. He wasn't like
your buddy Jay.
He's not like I'm on the front lines of the anti-woke mob. Like that's never been his persona. He's always been I'm the guy that everybody likes and I'm the friend. And so a lot of the stuff that a lot of the jokes he told in the 90s and early 2000s were completely benign in the minds of most of his audience now seem very different. And because he was not a confrontational figure to begin with, I think he has to acknowledge that. And I do give him credit because I think his apology seems sincere, or it's sincere in the sense that he's identifying the actual truth, is that this is not cancel culture and that it is a real thing that he should apologize for. But it is, shit, I had a point, I promise, that my brain farted out. No, I think it is an acknowledgement of how society has changed, and I give him credit for not being mealy-mouthed about it, about being full-throated about it. And it makes me happy. It acknowledges something that I've always felt, which is that a lot of this stuff, racism, sexism, homophobia, I wish people would treat it more like pollution or lead in the water, that it was just something we were all consuming, we were all a part of. Unless you were a part of one of those oppressed groups, you know, if you were just a straight white person like me living in regular culture, it just kind of was in the air. And was I out making, you know, Asians are bad drivers jokes? No, of course, because it just seemed hacky and corny, but I wasn't out picketing in the street. I wasn't out screaming, hey, don't do that either. It was just kind of like, ugh, that's such a lame joke. A lot of the sexist stuff that I wouldn't just stand by and accept now, I accepted because it was just in the air.
In the air, yeah.
And so I think that that might be kind of a way for the culture to heal. And a lot of younger people, I feel like maybe need to hear that message as well, to extend a little bit of grace towards people from a different generation. That it was
and
just
not even
something
just a hugely
all,
different generation, yeah. Right? Like not even a like Kevin Hart is not like 100 years old, right? Yeah. And he has the tweets of his are not like, you know, they were tweets, like they're from an era where Twitter existed, you
right.
know. So
but it's the existence
like
of social media,
the pace of change has been so rapid,
absolutely,
that like, you know, I think extending a little bit of and I'm not you know, LGBTQ, so it's not my place to accept a blah blah blah. I get that totally. But for people who want to make their apologies about their jokes about Muslims and terrorism, of which there are plenty, which probably Jay Leno can go ahead and issue one of those. Although for some reason nobody cares about Muslims right now, which is good and bad. But I would say for you know. I'm here to like listen to those, you know. I'm down. I am so and extending grace and being like, yes, I love it. Let's get the message out there, and because let's use your fame to also get the message out there. It's not cool, you know, to conflate Muslims with terrorism or whatever the fucking joke was. Okay. That is the end of the show. Oh my God. It was so fun having you guys on. And what I would really love is for the people of Fake the Nation to be able to follow you and all the good works that you do. George Tsiviris, where do they do that?
Yes, I'm at George Tsiviris, Tsiviris on all platforms. I have a Comedy Central set on presumably comedycentral.com. listen to my podcast Radio Lab. I host with Sam Taggart. Each episode explores a different element of straight culture. We have Meg Stalter this week, or next week rather. It was a pleasure to be here again.
And Christian Finnegan, where do they find you?
I'll be at the Pottery Barn.
Looking at throw pillows.
I work there now. I can be found on Ye Olde Twitter Machine at Christ Finnegan. And don't bother going to my website. I haven't updated it since 2015, I think. But does anybody go to websites anymore? Not really. But yeah, I'm on Twitter. That's probably the best place to find me. And if you live in or around New York City, you could do me a solid by coming to visit QED Astoria, which is the venue owned and operated by my wife. And we're starting to do shows again this spring, as we're legally allowed. And so check that out, qedastoria.com. And I have a new special/album called Show Your Work that will hopefully be coming out in June or July. But if you follow me on Twitter, I'll send out a signal flare when I know more.
Oh my gosh, I'm so glad you mentioned QED opening up in the spring, because it's such a big week for comedy venues in New York City. And I know everywhere in the country is on a different timetable or whatever. Some places are just open and have been open, but a lot of places are opening up right now. So shout out QED, places like New York Comedy Club. It's very exciting. And you folks, you know where to find me, but I just want to remind you of the premiere of the Adult Swim show Bird Girl. You can catch me on Bird Girl. I'm the character Meredith, so look out for Meredith. She's the mind taker. And on Sunday, we're actually doing a YouTube premiere of the show at 7 p.m. where you can follow the cast along. And the cast includes some crazy people like Tony Hale and Paget Brewster. It's really, really fun show. Really funny. And so I'll be on YouTube, live blogging along with the premiere of the show. So please join me there. And but what I really want to do is thank the people that make this show possible. That is our wonderful producer, Julia Linden, our fantastic audio engineer, Stephanie Aguilar, and all the wonderful people at HeadGum. Our theme music is written by Gabby Alter. And as always, rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts. Email us at fakethenation@headgum.com. Let us know what you think. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back in your earballs next week.
That was a HeadGum podcast.